In our continuing studies on the duties of our the godly home and family, we have gone through the fact that marriage is a sacred institution and that it joins together a man and a woman. And as a husband and wife, they are considered to be in holy matrimony, that each has given their God-given duties to one another. Now, we also considered the duties of husbands who are commanded to love their wives, to respect their wives, and to support their wives. Also, we considered the duties of wives who are commanded to submit to their husbands, to love their husbands, and to manage the home. God's purpose for marriage is to create families in which children have the benefit of parents. And they have the benefit of parents who provide the very best upbringing possible. For this to occur, parents must fulfill their duties before God. Now, we want to look at this since parents include the father and the mother. We want to look at this, first of all, from the duties of fathers. Fathers have a duty to provide the necessities of life. Parents ought to provide for their children. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 14. Paul says, "Now for a third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I do not seek yours but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children." This is something that is quite apparent that we realize as part of our responsibility. Now, a man who fails to provide for his family is worse than an infidel or unbeliever. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, Paul wrote, "If anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." It's hard to imagine how one could be worse than an unbeliever. But by neglecting this responsibility, that is exactly what happens. Then we are also told that fathers are not to provoke their children to wrath. This admonition is found twice in the scriptures. Once in Ephesians 6 and down at verse 4. "You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." Then over in Colossians 3 and verse 21, "Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." Now, Paul must have deemed this provoking business to be pretty important, because he included it in two of his epistles, and he approached it from two different angles. But how can we provoke our children? Well, I think that one of the ways that it's done is by unreasonable commands. That is, requiring children to do things that they just aren't equipped for. And sometimes parents put this upon children, not just fathers, but mothers too. And by needless severity, that is making a big deal out of very little things. And we have to pick what things are going to be important and not invoke severe punishment upon minor things. And third, by the manifestation of anger. Now, whenever we think about this, and by the way, these things all come from the pen of Albert Barnes in his commentary on these passages. Now, lest by our continual finding of fault with our children, they should lose all courage and despair of ever pleasing us, we must not provoke our children to wrath. But notice we also are responsible for providing spiritual training for our children. In the training, there must be discipline and an admonition of instruction of the Lord. This is taken from the ESV version, and I believe this is correct. Discipline and, instead of admonition, instruction. Ephesians 6 and 4, you know, we read the King James, or the New King James. It says, fathers, do not provoke children to wrath. Bring them up into training. And then we notice this training is discipline and admonition. And this is instruction of the Lord. Now, training by way of instruction. Back in Deuteronomy, chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, we learn here that they were taught to take the words that they were commanded, and he says, they shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. This is the way we teach our children. We do it, first of all, diligently, but we talk of God's word when we sit in our house, when we walk by the way, whenever we lie down, and when we rise up. Also down in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 46, we're told, he said to them, set your hearts on all the words which I testify among you today, which you shall command your children to be careful to observe all the words of this law. It was important that the children be taught and be instructed in the law of God. In the book of Psalms, the psalmist in Psalm 78 and verse 46 wrote these words, we will not hide them from their children, telling, let me go back and get this, we will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. Now you see, it is a progressive issue. You teach your children, they teach their children. They teach their children, on it goes. And this is the way that God intended. But note, the word must first come or be in the heart of the Father. It must first come from the Father. Then the Father can lead his family like Joshua did. And he said, remember in Joshua 24, verses 14 and 15, now therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. But notice also that training is also done by way of example. You know, just I want you to think about this scenario here. You realize that when a father is an active believer, now by active believer we mean that he's not just in word only, but definitely an active believer, there is about a 75% chance that his children will also be active believers. But notice this. If only the mother is a believer, this likelihood is reduced to 15%. That's what we are saying here by way of example. We train by what our children see. And if we're not training them to be faithful children of God, we can't expect anything like that. We just can't expect it. But we also notice that we have a responsibility to provide loving discipline. Now, the best example of this is discipline that is as the Heavenly Father gives or disciplines. In Hebrews 12, and beginning with verse 6, the writer says, "For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers," and now we're getting into it now, "human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as it seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness." Even though it may be unpleasant at times, we have to endure it. We're told in Hebrews 12, verse 11, "Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." Notice the objective is training. That's what we're trying to do. This is the very reason why the psalmist said by inspiration, and I'm sorry, the man of wisdom said by inspiration in Proverbs 13 and verse 24, he said, "He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly." Notice that. He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Now, in order to be fair, we're going to move on now from the duties of fathers to the duties of mothers. I think the most obvious thing is mothers have a duty to love their children. We notice that Titus is instructed by Paul in chapter 2 and verse 4 concerning older women now, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands and to love their children. This is an important fact. And, you know, you'd think, well, your children, of course you're going to love their children. No, that's not true. Women need to be taught to love their children. And also in this same regard, sin can lead to a lack of proper affection. Notice what Paul wrote in Romans 1 and verse 31. Undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, and unmerciful. Now, do you know what he was writing about there? He was writing about people who didn't like to have God in their heart or in their mind. They refused him. They denied that he existed. And what was one of the side effects of this? They became unloving. Tragically, and I say this with a great deal of sorrow, but tragically, more than 200 women literally kill their children in the United States each year. And this comes from recent information. The American Anthropological Association, November 2019. It's a sad, sad situation. And this is not, I'm not going into the subject of abortion in this lesson, but this is just outright up and kill 'em. So, you know, we need to be concerned about this and make sure that the mother loves her children. But also, she has a duty of managing her household. This is the primary responsibility of the wife and mother. Titus 2 and 5, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Now, I want you to look at that context for a moment. A failure to be discreet, a failure to be chaste, a failure to be a homemaker, a failure to be good and obedient to her own husband can cause God to be blasphemed. Now, those are serious implications. Serious indeed, and worthy of our consideration. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 14, Paul said, "Therefore I desire the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the house, and give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Now we're right back into this God being blasphemed again. When a wife fails in her responsibilities, God's name is blasphemed, and the adversary speaks reproachfully. But we want to understand, just a moment here, what the important qualities are of the, I guess, virtuous woman or the godly woman, because we have to understand that when we read through Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31, that we're looking at a woman that doesn't just bake bread all day, or sweep the floor all day. We're looking at a woman who is busy, a woman who sees to various other things. In fact, she, as a woman, has one of the most creative jobs in the world. Her job involves fashion, decorating, recreation, education, transportation, psychology, romance, cuisine, literature, art, economics, government, pediatrics, geriatrics, entertainment, maintenance, purchasing, law, religion, energy, and management. In fact, anyone who can handle all those has to be somebody special, and indeed, she is. She is a homemaker. This is a quote from Richard Kerr in Homemade, and it really spells it out. Really spells it out. But in addition to all this, she has a responsibility of providing spiritual training. Now, we saw that the husband has a responsibility in this regard, but this is especially true where there's no male leadership. As seen in the case of Timothy, his mother was a Jew, his father was a Greek, and in Acts 16 and verse 1, we're told that when Paul came to Derbe and Lystra, behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, a son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was a Greek. Now, his father being a Greek probably contributed to him being circumcised in Acts 16 and verse 3. Notice Paul wanted to have him go with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. This was not a matter of Paul showing the people that you have to conform to the law of Moses in order to be a Christian. That wasn't it at all. But in order to not set before him any possibility of a hindrance by having an uncircumcised man with him, he had him circumcised. Now, Timothy was spoken of as someone who is a faithful disciple. He was well spoken of in Acts 16 and 2, and all the brethren Lystra and Iconium and so forth. Now, with this in mind, I want you to keep in mind that his father was a Gentile, was a Greek, and he was a man who had his faith positively influenced by not a father, but by his grandmother and his mother. Look at 2 Timothy, verse 1. And down our chapter 1, verse 5. When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in you also. Isn't that something? Too often, fathers are not there for the spiritual training, and they leave the mothers to pick up the slack. Well, indeed, Lois and Eunice did their job. They did their job. But we know that the homes in which they have fathers fulfilling their duties as Christians, and mothers fulfilling their duties as Christians, they have a real advantage over the homes where this is not so. And don't get me wrong, no home is perfect. And as fathers and mothers, we often fall short. But with God's grace and His mercy, we can do, or we can all do the best that we can. We need to give our children the guidance that they're in need of so they may succeed where we have failed. Our next lesson is going to be the duties of children. And, you know, parents, we have responsibilities individually and collectively as parents, but children have duties too. So we're going to give that some consideration in our next study together. I'd like to leave with you some what I've called food for thought. This time, it's going to be 7 ways to impact your child's faith. First of all, model a growing and a personal faith. If your children don't see it, they won't catch it. I mean, it's just the facts. They may get it somewhere else, but they won't get it there. Model a growing and personal faith. And this is more than just packing them in a car and taking them to a church building. This is daily faith living in your life. And along that line, include faith in normal conversations. You remember when you read Deuteronomy 6 and 7? You are to talk to your children. Talk when you sit in the way. Talk when you're in the house. Talk when you walk. Lay down. Talk when you rise up. Talk. You're to do this on a regular basis. We have time to, all the time, to talk to our children about different things. But include faith in our conversations. Number 3. Be well-rounded. Now, by saying this, what I mean is, don't compartmentalize your faith. This is a mistake that's made too often. Faith is compartmentalized. Now, by that, what we mean is this. At 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, we turn it on. And it runs pretty good, maybe until 3 in the afternoon. But from then on, nothing's heard of it. Don't talk about it. We don't think about it until maybe 7:30 on Wednesday night. Then we click it back on, and only for an hour, and then we flick it back off again. The rest of the time, we're talking about things of this world and doing things of this world and on and on. And I don't mean things that are worldly, but I mean we're just caught up in life. And there's no manifestation of our faith on a daily basis. Be well-rounded. And this next one is important, be authentic. Children spot hypocrisy faster than anyone. That means you are what we say, they can do as you do and not as just you say. You know, you have a responsibility to set an example. and to do it authentically, not just going through the motions. Number 7. Oh, I'm sorry, number 5. I'm looking on my notes here instead of the charts. Serve together. Make serving God a family activity. That is such an important factor. You know, we've often thought of the idea of telling children, instead of "we have to go to worship," saying, "oh boy, we get to go worship God again at Sunday morning or Wednesday night, whatever," and making it something that we get to do, not something we have to do. And we do it together. We enjoy it together. Number 6. It ought to be here somewhere. There it is. Pray for your children and with your children. Model fervent prayer with your children. So many of you who have children or have had them along the way, I know you do this. You teach your children from the very earliest of time to pray to the God of heaven. And you teach them to pray for many different things. And this is an important factor, because teaching your children to pray will teach them to depend on God and to empty their hearts before God. Now, number 7. Finally, we got to number 7. Learn and communicate love in their language. Now, what I mean here is speak love in a language that they can understand. So they learn the love of God, the love of Jesus, the love of one another. Learn love and communicate love. So many children really never learn this. They never really learn it. Now, I can't take credit for it. This is a compiling of 7 things that impact your child's faith that was in a publication entitled The Relaxed Parent, written by Tim Smith. He really hit the nail on the head here. We appreciate your being with us today and your careful attention in the things we've been studying together. We hope that we'll be able to be with you again next week. And we're going to go right on, like I said, with the lessons on the home and the family.